Why is the shedding of blood important for the forgiveness of sins? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host from the Walla Walla University School of Theology. My conversation partners are again Larry Baverka and Dave Thomas, colleagues from the School of Theology. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today we're going to dive into Leviticus. My guess is that if someone had to take a book of Scripture with them to a desert island, could choose only one book of Scripture, my guess is that Leviticus would be their last choice. So, what does it teach us about the cross, the atonement in symbols, all of that blood? If our pastor today were to take an animal into the pulpit and shed blood, we would be horrified. So why is there so much blood?
Well, the whole idea of being horrified, probably it's part of it, is the very point.
But, Larry, for people who become very accustomed to that, and there bears no horror.
Well, I think that's true. We can probably become desensitized to just about it.
There are some religions that still have sacrifices, and when they become ritualized like that, they lose their horror. They retain a sense of mystery, but not a sense of horror.
I'd be curious about that. There is an emotion that comes with killing that may not be horror. It may be on the opposite side of things that would be an excitement that fuels or feeds the continuation of the practice.
There is, but I think people become rather inured, is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
To this kind of thing. I know before, for example, in the packing houses, before the days of mechanical executions, that they would rotate the person who actually did the destruction of the animal because they can become so calloused.
And as a matter, I think, at least I've heard, that in death penalty trials, they will not allow someone who is a butcher by trade to sit on there simply because of the hardening effect of killing animals.
Well, that might be an urban legend, but we'll
accept it. That might be an urban legend. Sounds like a good idea, don't you think?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, okay.
Your question is back to Leviticus, though, Alden.
Yes, Leviticus.
So push us a little bit.
Well, you've got this whole book that's dealing with sacrifices. Now, there is a passage there, Leviticus 17:11. It is the blood that makes atonement. That one apparently is reported in Hebrews 11 or cited in Hebrews 11:22. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Now, I'd like to suggest that there have been huge chunks in life, then and now, where the forgiveness of sin is not based exclusively upon the shedding of blood. When Israel was in Babylon, for example, they did not have any sacrifices. After the destruction of the temple in 87, there was no more animal sacrifices. And even Christ, we would say, once for all, finally brought all animal sacrifices to a close. But are there any other clues?
Well, the poor people didn't have to sacrifice an animal, as I recall in Leviticus. Some of them could bring various kinds of grain offerings.
Mm-hmm. If you were poor enough, you could bring a grain offering, which suggests that it wasn't just so much the blood, but it was the act of giving.
So can we make that more into a more universal statement about without the shedding of blood, and project back from the New Testament to suggest it was maybe an indication of what Jesus would do for redemption of humankind?
I suspect in some ultimate sense, and this may have even been sensed by Old Testament people when they went to child sacrifice, that if you're really going to pay the price, you have to take the life of that which is most central. So even though it wasn't universally practiced, there probably is an important psychological element there. And so that unless God comes and sheds his own blood, you really don't have the ultimate sacrifice. I think we could certainly see it pointed that direction. Now, my main concern would be those Christians who take a narrower view, who say, unless you specifically accept Jesus' blood, knowingly accept Jesus' blood, you cannot be saved. That's why evangelicals will not allow the good Muslim, the good Buddhist, the good heathen to be saved, because they have not explicitly accepted Jesus' blood.
Well, but the people in the Old Testament hadn't either.
That's right. See. And you have this remarkable passage in Romans 2, if you let us speak, that those who have not the law are judged apart from the law. So I don't have any problem seeing that Jesus' sacrifice is ultimate and the ultimate test of everything good. But I don't think people have to know about it or accept it. I think someday they will find out about that. So what do we do with Leviticus in terms of really understanding it?
Isn't it the case that the Hebrew understanding of the sort of holistic view of human existence and life, that functionality was tied to the body, and the life was in the blood, for example, and the heart is where decisions are made, the viscera is where emotions are seated. The life, when breathing stops, the life departs the the human being. And in that sense, then, this is about some sort of totality. I suppose you used the word ultimate. I mean, an ultimate giving, an ultimate sacrifice. And nothing less is conceived or perceived as meeting what's needed here.
If you're dealing with ultimate issues, ultimately, then it has to be a sacrifice of a life. I think we could even recognize that today.
But see, even in the jurisprudence system, we have this understanding that a life can be substituted for a life, or must be taken if another life is lost.
Yes.
So there is something about that I'm not sure we have plumbed. I don't mean just here, but in general, I don't know why it is that sacrifices do what they do.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to roll back a bit into a biblical story. We take the story of Cain and Abel, and our typical Christian interpretation of that is that the reason Cain's was not accepted was that it was not an animal sacrifice. And that may be an appropriate interpretation looking back at it, but if you actually go and look at the story itself, it seems to me that one could say it was his attitude that was wrong. The text itself does not specifically say you didn't bring the right sacrifice, but what he did was to bring the wrong attitude. Now, in that connection, and this is where I would like to get some interesting reaction from you, in Ellen White's understanding of the original sin in heaven, when Lucifer rebelled against the law of God, it wasn't until her third edition of the story, the Conflict of the Ages series, where she actually comes to the conclusion that Lucifer could have been restored to his position if he had simply given mental assent. Let me just read you a paragraph from Patriarchs and Prophets. Lucifer had not at that time fully cast off his allegiance to God. Though he had left his position as covering cherub, yet he had been, if he had been willing to return to God, acknowledging the Creator's wisdom and satisfied to fill the place appointed him in God's great plan, he would have been reinstated in his office. There's a few more comments along the same lines. In other words, at that early stage, before the disease had spread, it seems to me that you could make the case mental assent would be adequate. In fact, I try to do that in my classes. When a student has moved beyond the parameters of, for instance, absences, I will call them in. And I will say, if you will go straight from here, no more absences, I will not invoke the full penalty of the law. See? And so I use it as kind of a bargaining chip. This is the principle here, but if you're willing to come on board, then we'll do that. See, and it seems to me at the early stages, that's really what God is wanting to do. Is that pushing things too far?
No, I agree. I remember a passage. I've enjoyed reading Ellen White's description of those same events in Story of Redemption and the appeal that she makes to Satan to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And Satan's internal struggle, because I think even that appeal isn't just totally lost on him.
Mm-hmm.
His own internal struggle to honor that, and yet at the same time, his animosity, his jealousy of this other angel, Michael, who is given the privileges of deity somehow, and he's not, become too much of an impasse for him to make mm-hmm. that choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one more aspect of the sacrifices that I would like to highlight, and again, it's one of contrast. If you look at the story of Jesus' blood, we think of it in terms of cleansing, and in the Old Testament, the sacrifices had a lot to do with cleansing. You couldn't touch dead bodies, diseases, blood discharge, discharge of semen, lepers, all of that contamination. Now, when Jesus comes, though, he is not afraid to touch lepers, to touch the woman with a bloody discharge, and so on. What's going on there? How do you see God being consistent by working within that Old Testament framework where he has sharp distinctions? Sacrifices can work cleansing, but then when God himself comes, he tends to lay those aside. Do you have any visions of the night season that would help us to understand that?
Well, one thing that I think makes sense is if you don't have the physiological reason for sanitation, for example, by offering the germ theory and bacteria and virus and other sorts of things, you give a religious reason. And a religious reason can accomplish the same end in the sense that sanitation or sanitary practices might be adhered to and health improved without necessarily understanding the proper reasons for practicing that way.
And in a primitive society, religion would be a very powerful motivation.
Yes, it would.
Yeah. But we would say that ultimately there was probably a health reason behind that, because mm-hmm. these were all things that could be very polluting.
Mm-hmm.
So when Jesus comes, he comes with a message that he is not afraid of pollution. He touches lepers. And, of course, as society has gone on, we've developed more about germ theory, which helps us to understand that. But you're not afraid of people anymore when you follow Jesus' example. Ultimately, all of those symbols can be helpful for us, and giving the blood is the ultimate sacrifice of all. My thanks to Larry and Dave for their help with our conversations. Next week, we're going to talk about further symbols of the Old Testament. My thank you also to Josiah Hackerott, our program engineer, for the good word. I'm Alden Thompson. Thank you for listening in.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.